Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we continue our series on resisting Donald Trump by talking about what California state Democrats are planning. In November, California Democrats gained two-thirds of the seats in the Senate and Assembly, giving them the supermajority they need to pass legislation without Republican input. It also allows them to pass urgency clauses. Those are bills that would go into effect immediately after Governor Jerry Brown signs them. The California legislature has already introduced bills to finance immigrant legal services, train public defenders in immigration law, and bar state and local resources from being allocated to immigration enforcement. And then this morning we learned that California Democrats have hired former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder as an advisor. Joining me to talk about how California legislators are planning to resist Donald Trump are two guests. Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter with Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. Cal Matters is a nonprofit journalism venture committed to explaining how California's state capitol works and why it matters. And Laurel joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Laurel. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Happy to be here with you.
Great to have you. Dan Walters is a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Dan has been a journalist for more than half a century, spending all but a few of those years working for California newspapers. He's written more than 8,500 columns about California, so he knows the state really well. And Dan joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Cool. Thank you.
Great to have you. So, Dan, let's start off with you. We just got word this morning that U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, has been hired to serve as outside counsel to advise the state's legal strategy about the incoming Trump administration. How significant is this, and how unusual is this?
Well, it's more symbolic, probably, than having any material effect on what happens, but yeah, I mean, it's a way for the legislative leadership to demonstrate that they are, in the words of Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon, very, very serious about resisting Trump and whatever he plans to, what they fear that he will do to California if given a chance to do so.
And Laurel, what are your thoughts on this announcement?
I agree with my friend Dan. It's a big symbolic gesture to show that they're serious, that they're going to fight the Trump administration on several levels. You know, they're going to do what they can do in the legislature. They're going to probably pursue litigation. You know, there's going to probably be lawsuits. There's a widespread belief in Sacramento that California is going to become, under the Trump presidency, what Texas was under the Obama presidency, so that there's going to be a lot of legal tangles between the state of California and the federal government. And the fact that the legislative leaders retained Eric Holder, to me, is just further evidence of that paradigm.
It's also interesting because under the Obama administration, we saw mass deportations, more than George W. Bush, for example.
Yes, and I mean, I even saw some articles kind of pointing out that if Trump wants to be really serious about deporting undocumented immigrants, he could follow the model set by Obama. So that'll be interesting to watch out how that whole dynamic plays out in Washington. Certainly when it comes to the political rhetoric in Sacramento, the Democratic leaders in the legislature here are, trying to position themselves as much in opposition to Trump as they can. And it makes sense. Voters in California, you know, chose Hillary Clinton over Trump by like a 2-to-1 margin. So the politicians here have to, you know, show constituents that they are not on Trump's side.
Right. And we're going to do a show actually about President Obama's legacy and what he has left for Donald Trump. We're going to do a week-long series in 2 weeks, and one of those shows is going to focus on immigration. Laurel, you wrote a pretty lengthy piece for Cal Matters called Speed Crucial as Sacramento Democrats Brace for Trump Era. Because so many people have been focused on Donald Trump and the presidential election, a lot of people still don't even really know the outcome of what happened here in California. We had so many propositions and local issues that we voted on. But tell us about what happened in the Assembly and the Senate, where Democrats won a two-thirds majority.
Yeah, so the two most interesting things about the outcome of the election in terms of the makeup of the legislature is the first that the number of women in the legislature is down dramatically. There are only 22% of legislators now are women. That's the lowest it's been since like the early 1990s. So that was one interesting outcome. The other interesting outcome is that Democrats, you know, fared very, very well in this election, and they now have 2/3 control of both houses. So they have a little bit more than 2/3 in the Assembly, and they have exactly 2/3 in the Senate. And the reason that is kind of a magic number is that there's certain kinds of bills that can only be passed with a 2/3 vote. Now, most typically, we think of taxes. That's the really big, most controversial thing that cannot be approved without 2/3 support. Also, there's things like putting a constitutional amendment on the ballot for the voters to approve, and then there's certain like changes to the political ethics laws in the state that need to be approved by 2/3 of the legislature in order to be moved on to the governor. But there's also this procedural issue that they call an urgency clause. And as you said in the opening, you know, an urgency clause means that the bill goes into effect as soon as it's signed. Most bills, those that don't have an urgency clause, they go into effect usually the following year, maybe in January or July of the following year. But the urgency clause, in order to pass a bill with an urgency clause, it needs to be approved by 2/3 of the legislature. And because Democrats now have 2/3, they can conceivably pass more of these bills that go into effect immediately. And the Democratic leadership of the legislature is kind of seeing that as a procedural sort of tactic that they can use in fighting the Trump administration. And it all remains very hypothetical at this point. We don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, if, for example, a Republican-controlled Congress in Washington were to approve something like, say, repeal or change the Endangered Species Act or something like that, the California legislature could respond very quickly with a California-specific bill, and if it had an urgency clause, and if all of the Democrats held together and supported it and voted for it, it could go into effect immediately. So the Democrats in Sacramento are seeing this as sort of one tool in their tool belt to oppose Trump and a Republican-controlled Congress.
In one of the articles I read, Democrats said it's going to be like playing chess. When the Trump administration makes a move, they're going to make a move immediately. Dan Walters, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I think that they will try to make those kind of moves, but you have to put this in kind of context. Number one is whatever they do applies only to California. They can't change or really affect what Trump and the Congress do for the country as a whole. And number two, there are things that Congress and Trump can do that affect California that they have absolutely no way of resisting, such as eliminating Obamacare, under which several millions of Californians have received health care. Then that would create a dilemma for them as to whether the state should step in and try to replicate that coverage at state expense or what. But there's nothing they can really do about the fact that if Obamacare is repealed, and they have to react to it, but there's nothing they can do about it. Finally, I think it's important to remember that these 2/3 supermajorities are tenuous. There are substantial blocks of moderate Democrats in both houses of the legislature, and getting 2/3 votes for things is difficult, as it was shown a couple of cycles ago when they had 2/3 supermajorities in both houses and basically couldn't use them at all. So you have to say, you know, they have to pick their places, I should say. Finally, a lot of this is kind of for internal consumption. It's Democratic politicians in a Democratic state jumping up and down and screaming and yelling about what's going on in Washington. Largely, I think, or at least in part, just to get the troops stirred up in California. You remember, we've got another election coming up in 2 years, one for governor and possibly one for the U.S. Senate. So there's going to be a lot of politicians in California jumping up and down, trying to one-up each other on denouncing Trump just for internal consumption so that they can advance to the next level in politics. So you have to kind of take all this with a little bit of a grain of salt.
You think that Senator Feinstein might step down in 2 years?
I think it's possible. There are a lot of politicians that are kind of working on that contingency. I think, for example, you probably see Tom Steyer not declaring he's going to run for governor yet, because I think he's waiting to see what Dianne Feinstein does. There are rumors around that she might retire and will the Senate seat to Jerry Brown. Willie Brown is floating that notion. So it's still up in the air until she absolutely says, I am running, and absolutely takes out the papers and absolutely declares, which could be a year from now, then nobody knows for sure. And if she doesn't run, then the whole lineup of ambitious politicians in California gets jumbled up. Those who might be leaning towards running for governor now might jump into the Senate race. Those who are kind of biding their time might jump into the Senate race. But in the meantime, they're going to try to outdo each other on denouncing Donald Trump, because it's politically a safe thing to do. It's like the same thing as motherhood and apple pie someplace else, is denouncing Donald Trump and promising to protect California against all these terrible things that Donald Trump's going to do to the state. But you have to take it all with just a little bit of grain of salt and understand it's not just simple human outrage here at Moore. There's other calculations involved.
And Dan, we're talking about California, the state of California, but since you have been covering California politics for such a long time, I wonder what you think about now almost Senator Kamala Harris. She was sworn in yesterday. You know, a lot of people said that she kind of skated to Washington, D.C. The debates were not that interesting. We couldn't get her on the show. She didn't do that many interviews. What do you think? What role do you think she's going to play in Washington, D.C.?
Kamala Harris has skated throughout her entire political career. Willie Brown sponsored her to become district attorney of San Francisco. She then became attorney general without any significant competition, at least within the party. She had a Republican opponent, and skated into the U.S. Senate seat. She is kind of and she has attorney general. She's made a lot of pronouncements. She's done a lot of politically correct things, but when it comes to making tough decisions, she's never really made one yet. And so all these people are saying Kamala Harris is the next president of the United States, or some words to that effect. Sit back and see how she does as senator. I mean, she's never really been tested, the truth be known.
Laurel, what do you think?
You know, her reputation as attorney general was that she was extremely cautious, and she was largely protected by the fact that that office has such a big role in writing the descriptions for the ballot propositions. So she wasn't forced to kind of take a position on a lot of them because she was protected by that wanting to kind of, you know, remain neutral because of her office's role. So she is definitely has been less out there in taking a stand. And it'll be interesting to see, as, you know, in the minority party in Washington, whether that will kind of force her to be a little bit more more forthright and with taking positions, or if, because she'll be one of, you know, 100 senators, she can kind of, you know, work with the group and not have to take a strong stand.
Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter with Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. Cal Matters is a nonprofit journalism venture committed to explaining how the state capitol works and why it matters. And Dan Walters is a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. He's written more than 8,500 columns about California, so he knows the state very well. And today we are continuing our series on resisting Donald Trump by talking about what California state politicians are planning. California Democrats gained 2/3 of the seats in the Senate and the Assembly, giving them the supermajority they need to pass legislation without Republican input. But as Dan has said and Laurel has written about, there's no guarantee that the Democrats are going to be in line. In fact, a couple of articles say that lobbyists are going to now focus on moderate Democrats. So we'd love to hear from you on this issue. What do you hope to see from California lawmakers? What questions do you have about the power that they now have with the supermajority in Sacramento? What do you think about the supermajority? What do you want them to do with this power? As Dan said, take a lot of this with a grain of salt. Some of it could just be posturing. What are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to talk about your state representative, your congressional representative, what he or she is doing on these issues, and what leadership do you want to see from them? Also, do you know who they are? Laurel, it seems like now is a good time to really get to know your senator or assembly member, because especially if it's a moderate and you want him or her to vote on bills that affect immigration or climate change.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I hope that your listeners will go to calmatters.org today, or check us out on Twitter, CalMatters, or on Facebook. We just today posted a new kind of fun interactive tool explaining who the legislature is. And you can kind of plug in your own demographic characteristics, your, you know, ethnic and gender identity, et cetera, your age, and you can see how many legislators in California are like you and how many are not. So that's on our website at CalMatters.org. And yeah, it's really great for people to kind of tune in and see who's like them. Now, this is our tool today is focused very much on demographics, not on the political identity of these legislators. But, you know, we're reporting on them year round in terms of who votes for what kinds of policies.
I just took your quiz. California legislators just like you. There are zero legislators like me in California.
Yes, if you're a woman, you're automatically going to be a lot less likely to have any legislators like you. If you're a man, if you're particularly a man named Jim, for whatever reason, there are a lot of men named Jim in the legislature this year, you have better odds of having a legislator like you.
That's kind of amazing in a state like California.
Yep.
Dan, do people know their legislators well? You know, when we do shows and we say, what should we do about this? Everyone says, call your senator. We're talking about, you know, for example, Kamala Harris now or Barbara Boxer. But do people call their state representatives? Are people engaged with their state representatives?
Yes, they do. But I would say as a general observation that the people in more rural areas and perhaps some suburban areas know their legislators better than those in urban areas, simply because there are so many of them and the districts are, and everything kind of overlaps in these major urban areas, the Bay Area and Southern California. So it's hard to know who your legislator is. The districts, the boundaries of the districts go here and there and everywhere, and it's very difficult to know who they are. You can look it up, of course, and find out who it is. But out in the more rural areas of California, in the Central Valley and in the Inland Empire and places like that, they know who their people are because there's only one of them. There's not like five of them in the neighborhood. And I think they do get a lot more feedback in those areas than they do in urban areas.
And what's most effective? One politician, I think it was Steve Israel, who's leaving Congress, said what's most effective is to go to the office physically if you have the time.
I think it depends on the issue. I think if you have some specific problem that needs to be solved, I think going to the office makes a lot of sense because legislators, both state and federal, have people who work what they call casework, you know, people helping people with their Social Security payments or something like that. Just showing up and handing them a letter at the receptionist, I don't know that does much good. Really, this is going to sound very cynical, but I think it's very true. The best thing to do is to have a lobbyist. That's the way and that sounds kind of weird, but the truth is we all have lobbyists, every single one of us, all 39.4 million Californians have at least one lobbyist looking out after our particular interests, whatever they are. If you're a motorist, you have a lobbyist. If you're a boater like me, you have a lobbyist. If you're a lawyer, you have a lobbyist. If you're a business person, you have a lobbyist. If you're a labor union member, you have a lobbyist. You all have lobbyists. There are like 10,000. No, there's about 1,200 of them in Sacramento, about 10 for every legislator. Mm-hmm. So you're really, if you really are seriously interested in an issue that affects you, maybe the thing to do is go through one of your affiliate your interest groups and contact the lobbyist who deals with them.
And lobbyists are going to be targeting moderate Democrats. What's the breakdown among the Democrats in Sacramento? How many would you say are progressive and how many are moderate?
Well, that's very difficult to say because it's a kind of a floating group. The Mod Squad, as some people call them, in the Assembly, has been fairly well established now for a couple of cycles. And there's maybe 8, 10, 12 sometimes. It depends on the issue.
Right.
They're not all the same on every issue. Maybe there's 3 or 4 or 5 in the Senate. And these aren't just people who happen to show up. These are people who were generally elected with the help of business and employer and other organizations that are opposed to the other power centers in the capital, which tend to be things like labor unions and environmentalists and consumer protection people and trial lawyers and so forth. And so these battles were fought in the electoral arena going in. So, for example, although the Democrats did pick up seats, as we mentioned before, and do have two-thirds supermajorities on paper, in fact, the ranks of the moderates also expanded in that same election. So until you actually get to the point of getting into legislation and everything, we won't know what that effect will be. But they have been very effective in the past two or three cycles, and one can expect they're going to be very effective. What I think will happen is the leadership will try to come up with issues that promote solidarity, maybe on immigration or something like that, rather than issues that there would be divisiveness over, like raising taxes or something like that. So they're going to try to weld these two-thirds supermajorities into acting together on some fairly easy issues, I think, before they try to get them to act on very hard issues like raising taxes. There are a number of tax increase things floating out there for transportation, for housing, for other things, and that's the sort of thing I think you'll see. Like I said before, when they had the two-thirds supermajorities before, after the 2012 elections, they were virtually not used at all. They couldn't really get them together to do anything, and whether they can get them to do anything substantial in this new biennial session remains to be seen. Hmm.
And they don't need a Republican vote for tax increases, right?
Well, if they get all the Democrats to vote for them,
right.
Yeah. But you have to get all the Democrats to vote for them. That's a very, very tricky thing to do. And when it comes to things like raising gas taxes, they really don't want to have Democrats raising gas taxes and Republicans standing on the sidelines saying, here, you're trying to sock it to the motorists. What they would like to have is something that at least a few Republicans would support so that they had some political cover. But whether they can do that or not, I don't know. They haven't been able to really wield these supermajorities in the past on other than very small issues. And so we'll see whether they have more success in the upcoming session.
Well, let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I hope that people don't put too much on the fact that the Democrats have the supermajority. I've listened to your guests, and I agree. If that meant that we were going to get progressive change, we'd have already gotten it. And I'm looking at issues like health care, affordable housing, other things like that, that the Democrats really haven't done a lot. I mean, we've got the Ellis Act, Costa-Hawkins bill. We still have Prop 13 in effect. And the Democrats really haven't moved this. So I think that the one thing I think that may help is that at the local level, if people can apply pressure, whether it's through social media, organizing, and going to their local offices, whatever, I think that's the only way you're going to get the change, if it's possible at all. So I'm not convinced the Democrats we're going to get into progressive heaven here because we've got a two-thirds majority in both houses.
Laurel, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I would say that overall the legislature is dominated by Democrats, but not necessarily super liberal progressive Democrats. The main political tension in Sacramento is the tension between the more business-oriented, moderate Democrats and the more progressive environmentalist and labor union oriented Democrats. That's the primary political tension in Sacramento. The Republicans have so little influence here. They hold no statewide office. They have less than a third of the seats in the legislature. And so while we do sometimes see some kind of, partisan bickering or disagreement, the general kind of big political question mark is always how much are the Democrats going to hang together versus how much are there going to be those who side with the business interests and those who side with the more liberal interests. And as the caller said, certainly on issues like housing, there there is a divide, environmental issues, labor issues. I think that the one kind of exception on this division is probably going to be on immigration issues. And it remains to be seen what comes forward. But I think that we're going to be most likely to see the two different wings of the Democratic membership in Sacramento hang together on issues of immigration, particularly if that means kind of supporting a more liberal, more welcoming kind of approach in California that that welcomes undocumented immigrants in opposition to a federal policy that might be more hardline. So a lot of the moderate Democrats that are in the legislature are people of color. A lot of them come from communities of color. A lot of them are Latino and come from families that have included a lot of immigrants. So those are areas. Although that, you know, many of those moderate Democrats are going to be less in line with the environmental side of the Democratic Party, they are more likely to kind of be on the same page on issues related to immigration.
Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter with Cal Matters, where she covers California politics, and Dan Walters is a political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. On today's Your Call, we are continuing our series on resisting Donald Trump by talking about what California state politicians, Democrats really, are planning. And actually, after the break, I'd love to find out if any Republicans have expressed plans to take on Donald Trump. We'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard on today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our series on resisting Trump by talking about how tech workers are planning to resist Trump. Top executives met with Donald Trump last month, but tech workers were signing on to a neveragain.tech. It's a pledge to refuse to build databases of people based on their religious beliefs. The pledge says, "Today we stand together to say not on our watch and never again." That is tomorrow, and then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And then coming up on Monday, we'll talk about the future of the Democratic Party. Today, we are talking about how Democrats in California are planning to resist Donald Trump. In November, California Democrats gained 2/3 of the seats in the Senate and the Assembly, giving them a supermajority needed to pass legislation without Republican input. They can also pass urgency clauses, and those are bills that would go into effect immediately after Governor Jerry Brown signs them. But as we're hearing, a lot of Democrats in Sacramento are moderate on many issues, which means that they will not be in line on all of these issues. We're talking about immigration, the environment, and civil rights. And today we're speaking with Laurel Rosenhall, a reporter with Cal Matters, where she covers California politics, and Dan Walters is a political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. And if you'd like to join us, what action do you want California lawmakers to take? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on Twitter or Facebook or our website. And let's go next to Joey in San Francisco. Hi, Joey. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I want to say that I feel like what's missing in the show is it's got to be a full confrontation with the fact that this is a fascist regime that's coming to power, and it's going to take the actions of millions of people. If you want to talk about the real supermajority, millions of people and tens of millions of people across society. And today RefuseFascism.org has placed an ad in the New York Times calling for exactly that kind of resistance. And imagine if tens of millions filled the streets powerfully declaring that this regime is illegitimate and demanding that it not be allowed to rule. The whole political landscape would be dramatically transformed, and every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond, and all that could lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. And I think that's what people need to focus their attention and energy. This isn't some kind of an idle dream, but something that could be made a reality if everyone who hates what is represented by this regime translates their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible. I think it's great what the NAACP has done in Alabama, you know, setting in the offices of Jeff Sessions, who's a ardent, you know, segregationist and white supremacist, and is poised to become the Attorney General. This is an intolerable situation, and it's going to require the actions of millions of people to not figure out how we're going to survive fascism, but how we're going to stop it before it starts.
Well, yesterday, if you haven't heard yet, and people were arrested, six people were arrested, including the NAACP president last night. They were holding a sit-in in Mobile, Alabama. This is the office of U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions, who is the nominee for Attorney General. And a lot of people are saying that they're going to mobilize until he steps down, until he is no longer the nominee. And we did a show yesterday about resisting, about the power of protest, about what is planned. There's a women's march that is planned for the day after the inauguration all across the country. Laurel, what are you hearing in California? I mean, there's going to be actions in Berkeley, Oakland, Sacramento, I'm sure other cities. But what are you hearing in terms of organizing on the ground?
Well, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that that Donald Trump won the presidency with playing the rules of the game that are the existing rules. Republican Congress won control of Congress, playing the rules of the game that we have established. So those people who are unhappy about the outcome might want to think about changing the rules of the game. We've seen that happen in various ways in California. For example, redistricting. You know, it used to be a gerrymandered situation where the politicians who hold these seats got to draw the lines, and they basically drew districts that favored them. California voters threw that system out a few years ago, put in independent redistricting. Most states don't have that. So we have independently drawn political districts in California. That's not the case in many other states. Many other states, you have politicians drawing the districts in a way that benefits their own reelection or the party of whoever has control in that state. So, you know, that's an example. The Electoral College, you know, there are legislators. I don't think that California alone is going to change the Electoral College, but there are legislators in California trying to work on changing the Electoral College system. There are legislators in other blue states working on changing it. I don't see that happening quickly, but there are, you know, people who are maybe working on a long game about changing that system. Here in California, when you talk about changing the rules of the game, and I know this is something that Dan has written about, we had a few years ago legislators in the middle of the night passed a bill that moved all of the ballot initiatives, instead of having some of them on the June ballot and some of them on the November ballot, they moved all of them to the November ballot. And while that might seem like meaningless to a lot of people, the reality is that the turnout in the general election in November is a lot. You have a lot more progressive people who come out and vote in November than who vote in a primary in June. So the outcome of moving all the initiatives is that you have better odds of a progressive ballot measure, for example, marijuana legalization, passing if it's on a November ballot than on a June. So these are ways that that people and governments have changed the rules of the game in order to change the outcome. And it seems to me that, you know, that is a very, it takes a long time, but it is an effective way of making change, because you change the rules and then, you know, down the line, you leads to a different outcome.
Dan, how would you respond to Joey? I mean, this is what we're dealing with is really unprecedented. Donald Trump just announced that his SEC pick is Jay Clayton, a lawyer, actually an elite lawyer, according to CNN, who has defended big banks for their financial crisis misbehavior, according to CNN. But I mean, a lot of this is unprecedented. The people that he is choosing do not believe in government. They don't even believe in the agencies that they will possibly lead. So what are your thoughts about, you know, how people are responding? What are you hearing from people about organizing?
Well, I haven't heard much of all about organizing, but it's natural that people are going to resist the change, particularly what appears to be, although we don't know for sure yet, to be rather massive policy change in Washington. But that's what happens in politics. Those who win get to name who will run these agencies, and the agencies have policies. And there are a lot of people who didn't like what Obama has done with his agencies and his appointees. And there are going to be a lot of people who don't like what Trump does with his agencies and his appointees. But that's the nature of politics. If you don't like it, you go out and you get somebody else elected. And it's, what's the alternative? That somebody comes in, wins an election, and says, well, I'm not going to change anything because, gee whiz, it shouldn't change anything. That's the nature of politics. Things change. Changes when you get a new governor. It changes when you get a new president. It even changes when you get a new mayor in a city. Things change. And you can resist it. You can protest it. You can jump up and down and hold your breath and all that stuff. But that's the nature of politics. If you don't like it, you go out and get somebody else elected.
Well, this is really unprecedented change, though.
Is it?
Yeah.
How unprecedented is it? Is it more unprecedented than when Franklin Roosevelt became president in 19?
Well, in our lifetimes,
or when Ronald Reagan took over from Jimmy Carter. I don't know that it's that impressive. We don't know. You don't know what's going to happen. Everybody's jumping up and down based on supposition of what they think is going to happen, but nobody knows until it happens. And it's kind of almost amusing to see people think. I think a lot of it is that it's so much unprecedented change is that people didn't expect him to win. Everybody in the Democratic Party was absolutely certain that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and therefore it's disappointment that she didn't win, coupled with the fact of who did win, Donald Trump, this unknown kind of bombastic billionaire. But we can, you know, all these fears is like boogeyman coming in. I mean, the boogeyman's coming to get us. We have to hide under the covers. Wait until it happens. Wait until actually something happens and then react to it, rather than all this kind of guesswork, because it is guesswork, because he's not very transparent on what he's going to do. He changes his mind seemingly every other day, and he tweets this, and he tweets that, and he does this, and he does that. He's a very erratic sort of person. But you can't really say for certain what's going to happen until it happens.
Dan Walters is a political columnist with the Sacramento Bee, and Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter with Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. And if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about how California politicians are planning to resist Donald Trump. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say two things. One is, your guest there that's talking about, well, Donald Trump won by the rules of the game. I would just point out that Hitler came to power through democratic procedures, including through the process of elections, and no one should respect fascism, regardless if it came to power fair and square or what have you. And then your other guest saying we should take a wait-and-see approach. Wait-and-see? Donald Trump has already told the world. And look at the cabinet that he's put around him. It's a cabinet. It's a cabal of psychopaths and monsters and fascists. And half of them want to destroy the departments that they've been picked ahead. And the other half have said things like that Islam, not Islamic fundamentalists, you know, people who take up Islam in a terroristic way, but just Islam itself is a terroristic religion. They've said really horrific things, and including Trump himself. So a wait-and-see approach about fascism? I don't think so.
Well, thank you for calling in, Frank. Let's go next to Glenn in San Francisco. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thanks for letting me speak to you. I'm referring to a story that I heard this morning on Democracy Now! By David Dayan of The Intercept about Kamala Harris and her non-prosecution of One West Bank, Steve Mnuchin's bank, which I think he called a foreclosure machine, and also that she received something like $20,000 contribution from Mnuchin to her senatorial campaign.
Well, thank you. I did not hear that, but I heard about the piece, and we might be getting David Dayan on Friday's show. So hopefully we can get David and we'll talk more about that story. And Steve Mnuchin is Donald Trump's nominee to head the Treasury Department. And the Intercept piece is Treasury nominee Steve Mnuchin's bank accused of widespread misconduct in leaked memo. And this bank, a lot of people lost their homes from this bank. It was Bank One, I believe, but we will put One West. We'll put this on the website right after the show. Thank you for that. We have a couple of emails. Tim says, the reason we got here was because Democrats abandoned the issues that define them, labor, environment, civil rights. Since we're stuck with a two-party system, we need to make sure that those who vote moderate know they will be voted out. Show up for citizens before corporations. We have an email from Robin Hayward who says, one of the top priorities in the face of the impending repeal of Obamacare should be a state-based universal health care system. I think there may be a number of states who might consider resisting Trump in a similar fashion. Well, we don't know what's going to happen. In fact, I heard one politician this morning on NPR say she doesn't really know if people are going to lose their health care in the meantime. And Dan, you've been writing about this. What happens here in California, people who have Obamacare through Covered California, if Obamacare is repealed?
Well, if Obamacare is repealed, they'll probably lose it. There's been millions of people have been added to the health insurance ranks, some receiving subsidies for private insurance. Several million people going on the Medi-Cal rolls, and it costs. The feds are putting a lot of money into health care in California through both of those mechanisms, but particularly through Medi-Cal. If the state, if Obamacare goes away, the state will be faced with a really, really tough decision as to whether to drop several million people off of the Medi-Cal rolls, people who were added as a result of Obamacare under relaxed qualifications, or pick up the tab themselves. And we're talking about maybe $15 billion a year, something like that.
Wow.
So that's but there's very little the state can do about that. If Obamacare goes away, Obamacare goes away. The state, there's no recourse for the state or any other state. And it so happens, there's an irony attached to this, is that California embraced Obamacare like nobody else did. Mm. I mean, we really went full bore in the thing. Therefore, if it goes away, California and Californians get hit harder than those of any other state. And there's a further irony, is that the congressional district in California that has the highest level of Medi-Cal recipients under Obamacare is that of Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader of the House. So, I mean, it's going to hit these rural areas, many of them represented by Republicans, harder than it's going to hit people in the cities. It's a big deal, but there's very little the state can do about it. They can't really not, they can lobby against it, but if Congress and Trump do away with Obamacare, The state's only recourse will be to decide whether to pick up the tab themselves, and it's a very, very, very high tab.
Laurel, we're getting a couple emails about what happens if Obamacare is repealed. What are you hearing from politicians in Sacramento?
You know, what I'm hearing is that they don't want to lose Obamacare, but that they don't want to pay for it, and from out of state coffers if the feds do away with it. So while there is a lot of messaging kind of coming about, like, oh, we're going to fight the federal government to protect our environmental laws, and we're going to fight to protect our immigrants, I am not hearing the same kind of strong rhetoric from Democratic leadership in Sacramento when it comes to the question of maintaining a public health care system that's paid for by the state government, because, as Dan said, that is just a huge bill. I mean, it's many, many, many billions of dollars. What is it, Dan? I thought it was $24 billion or something.
Well,
in the budget.
About 15 for Medi-Cal alone, plus whatever the subsidies for the private insurance are. There's some billions more than that, I think.
So it's too big of a hole for the state to fill. And so the sense that I'm getting is that they're telling their voters and their constituents that, you know, we can't promise to fill that hole.
And Laurel, every time we do a show about health care, people write in or call about health care for all in California. A couple of bills actually did pass under Schwarzenegger, but he vetoed them. What's the word on that in Sacramento?
Well, actually, you know, one of my colleagues is looking into that issue, but there is, you know, if the federal government repeals Obamacare, then, right, you know, the California program that covers undocumented immigrants is the speculation at this point is that that would be, you know, first on the chopping block, but I mean, covers undocumented children. So we're looking into that to kind of get more facts. And it's, you know, as we keep saying, it's hard to know right now. Donald Trump hasn't even been sworn in yet. So we don't know exactly what proposals will be coming. But certainly, journalists will keep an eye on it, and Democratic politicians in Sacramento will be doing everything they can to show voters that they are opposing Trump.
And what are you both hearing from politicians in Sacramento about climate change? Trump has nominated a number of climate change deniers to head various departments, including the Environmental Protection Agency. And in the New York Times, Kevin De Leon, the leader of the state Senate, says California is committed to moving forward on our climate leadership. We will not deviate because of one election. Dan, what are you hearing from politicians on climate change?
Well, I think they're making a lot of noise about it, Jerry Brown particularly, because that's one of his, he considers that one of his legacy issues and so forth. But we have to keep this in mind. The state can do whatever it wants to do on climate change. The feds cannot prevent California from having cap and trade or all the other, or setting standards for utilities or all the other things that they're doing to reduce carbon emissions. That's a state thing. They can do whatever they want to do. They may not have a willing, happy, supportive partner in Washington, but there's nothing that the Obama people can really do to prevent California from going doing whatever it wants to do to reduce carbon emissions. What it does, potentially, is make California more of an outlier. If it's happening in California, but it's not happening in the rest of the United States, then it has perhaps an adverse economic impact on California. But California can do whatever it wants to do on climate change. There's nothing that Trump's can or going to do to stop California from doing that.
Laurel, you reported that Kevin De Leon's top aide, Dan Reeves, said he could imagine using urgency legislation to respond if Congress were to repeal or restrict the Endangered Species Act. And High Country News is reporting that Utah Representative Rob Bishop says he wants to scrap the Endangered Species Act altogether. So how would the state respond if something like this were scrapped?
Oh, I think that they could do that. Honest, again, applying only to California, they couldn't do it for their whole country. They can have an Endangered Species Act in California if they wish to have an Endangered Species Act. There's nothing in what Trump could do that would prevent California from doing what it wants to do on a whole variety of environmental issues within the borders of the state. That's why some of this rhetoric is a little overheated. because really California is free to do whatever it wants to do in these things.
Laurel?
Oh, well, you know, what really changes is that, you know, California's position as, you know, quote unquote leader for the nation on these issues versus as a more random outlier, right? So under the Obama administration, California had more stringent environmental rules than the federal government on the climate change issue. You know, we had these extremely aggressive emissions reductions goals that are in our state laws that aren't changing because of a change at the federal government. But the question becomes more, how much does the federal government sort of, instead of trying to nudge the rest of the country to catch up with California, how much does the federal government sort of push everyone to a complete the opposite direction? And I think that's what we're very likely to see, is that California's plan becomes more and more an outlier, or maybe we band together with Oregon and Washington with this kind of left coast approach to climate change.
Right, exactly. I mean, getting rid of laws that have been on the books for a long time and obviously work and are very, very important. And then as a state, you have to respond to that. And then you have a piecemeal laws across the country. I mean, that's just a lot of work that a lot of people don't want to do.
Yeah, and shouldn't do. One thing we haven't touched on so far is the role that a new attorney general could play in California. And as you mentioned earlier, Kamala Harris, who had been the attorney general for the last few years, was just sworn in yesterday as the new U.S. Senator for California and Washington. Jerry Brown has nominated Congressman Javier Becerra to fill the position as attorney general. He was a congressman, or he still is a congressman from Los Angeles, had that role for about 20 years. Before that, he was a legislator in Sacramento and a deputy attorney general in the attorney general's office. So he is going to be facing, you know, nomination hearings and votes in the state legislature in the upcoming weeks. And we will, he's seen as a key piece of the Democrats' agenda to fight Trump.
Laurel Rosenhall is a reporter at Cal Matters, where she covers California politics. Cal Matters is a nonpartisan, nonprofit journalism venture committed to explaining how the state capitol works. And Dan Walters is a political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. Laurel and Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
And coming up tomorrow, we will continue our series on resisting Donald Trump. We'll be talking about how tech workers plan to resist Donald Trump. About a month ago, tech executives met with Donald Trump in New York, while at the same time, tech workers were signing on to a pledge to refuse to build a database of people based on their religious beliefs. It's called NeverAgain.Tech. The pledge says, "Today we stand together to say, not on our watch and never again." So what actions will the tech sector take to resist Trump? And if you work in tech, what are you planning? Your Call is produced at KALW. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining.